Russia and Trump under the microscope today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. FBI Director James Comey confirms it. His agency is investigating Russia's efforts to interfere in the election.
And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts.
Also, a genetic experiment to eliminate malaria in one African village. It's never been tried before, and it's risky.
Once you test a gene drive animal by letting it out, it could spread everywhere, and you'll only discover the implications after it already might be too late.
Plus, Chuck Berry's favorite curry restaurant in Nottingham, England. That's all ahead, right here today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Thanks for being here this Monday. It's not fake news. FBI Director James Comey confirmed today that there is an investigation underway into Russian interference in the presidential election last year. The confirmation came as Comey sat through a marathon question and answer session in front of the House Intelligence Committee. He said the Bureau is looking at possible contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Sitting next to him was the head of the National Security Agency, Admiral Mike Rogers. The World's Matthew Bell was also watching and listening, and he joins me in the studio now. So what did we learn about this investigation today?
Yeah, so the main thing we learned is that, as you mentioned, it's real. It's happening. Comey didn't want to give many details about this because it's an ongoing investigation. He declined to answer many, many questions from members of the House Intelligence Committee. But he said that these are special circumstances. There's a lot of interest, a lot of pressure, and that he needed to acknowledge that the investigation is underway. We've been talking, of course, about Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election for some time. Reporting on that has been going on for weeks, and we've talked about possible connections between Trump campaign officials and the Russian government. The big picture here is that this might very well be unprecedented. I called up Daniel Dresner, who's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Here's how he put it into context.
It's pretty surreal. You know, there have been accusations in the past of campaigns colluding with foreign governments. But I think this is the first time I can think of where there has been an official investigation by the FBI into whether a campaign has had contacts with a country that would be perceived of as a rival or an adversary to the United States. That is, I believe, unprecedented.
So we've got to remember there was that FBI, NSA, CIA report some weeks ago on Russian meddling in the U.S. election, but now we learn the FBI is continuing that investigation. Did you find out through this committee hearing today exactly what the FBI is looking at?
Not a lot of details, Marco. They talked a little bit about motivation, though, and sort of the context of the investigation. Members of the Intelligence Committee asked about Russian intentions, about is Russia an adversary? Yes. Is Vladimir Putin – what was he interested in with the election that was going on? Mike Rogers was there next to Comey. He's the director of the National Security Agency. And one thing that both Comey and Rogers were clear about is that the Russian government wanted Donald Trump to win the election, that the Russians did not like Hillary Clinton. They wanted her to lose. And if she was going to win, which apparently they thought at some point was inevitable, that they would try to at least undermine the Clinton administration, the incoming Clinton administration's credibility, if they possibly could. Here's some of what Comey had to say about Russian activities during the election.
They were unusually loud in their intervention. It's almost as if they didn't care that we knew what they were doing or that they wanted us to see what they were doing. It was very noisy, their intrusions in different institutions.
Yeah, that is pretty extraordinary. Matthew, what about the million-dollar question that everyone was waiting an answer to? Was Donald Trump right when he claimed that Trump Tower was wiretapped by President Obama? What did Comey say about that?
Comey was indeed asked about it, and this is based on Donald Trump's tweets and statements from administration officials that President Obama had wiretapped Trump Tower. Here's what Comey had to say.
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets.
Again, just did not answer many, many questions about details of what exactly they're looking for, how far things have gone. He did say, interestingly, that the investigation started in July of 2016, that it is ongoing, but he wouldn't say how – he wouldn't guess in any way how long it would take for – for everything to be carried out.
Mm. Obviously, Congress plays a role in all of this. That's why Comey is on the Hill today. So what do members of the House Intelligence Committee actually want, especially when things are so partisan right now?
This was the thing that was striking to me is as you're watching the question and answer session here is that it's almost like there were two separate hearings going on. One was from the Republican members of the Intelligence Committee, for the most part, interested in one thing, and that is the leaks. They wanted to know, what is the FBI, what's the government doing to track down the sources of these leaks? And they say, this is illegal. This is a serious infraction. This is classified information that's being handed to the news media. They wanted to express their outrage about this. And then you have the Democrats, and they want something entirely different. They want to go big. For them, this issue is very complicated. They want to open it up to include everything. And they have talked about the need to get a special prosecution going, to also look at possible criminal investigation into members of the Trump administration and in illegal contacts with the Russians. So this is just the beginning of a process here.
The World's Matthew Bell. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
A Russian connection, potential conflicts of interest, not Washington. In this next case, London. This story involves George Osborne, who served as Britain's equivalent of Treasury Secretary in David Cameron's government. It's considered one of the most powerful positions in the UK. And by the way, Osborne is still a member of Parliament for the Conservative Party. But recently, he also got a plum new job, editor of the Evening Standard tabloid, kind of London's version of the New York Post. And the Standard just happens to be owned by the son of a Russian billionaire. Osborne got the job even though he has no journalism experience at all, and he'll remain a member of Parliament. Now, we here in the U.S. are no strangers to the revolving door between media and the government. Think George Stephanopoulos, or more recently, Corey Lewandowski. Aditya Chakraborty is a columnist with The Guardian newspaper. He says George Osborne has taken the revolving door to a whole other level.
Let me put it this way. If I were to hear a dispatch in small hours of the morning that the recently purged finance minister of a small island and still one of the most senior members of the ruling party in Parliament had been installed as the editor-in-chief of the capital's leading newspaper, and that he'd been handed that job by the son of a Russian oligarch, I would tend to think that had come from some place, perhaps somewhere south of the Sahara, one of those countries that people talk about as being riddled with corruption. But it isn't. It's happening in one of the richest and most developed countries in the world, in Britain, which also prides itself as being the mother of parliamentary democracy. That's what I think is the bottom line of this episode, is it gives you a real insight in how 21st century Britain is run nowadays. And the answer to that question is actually 21st century Britain is run a lot like 18th century Britain, which is that power is wielded and handed about by a small clique of people. You've got to remember, if Tim Geithner had left office in 2013.
Former Treasury Secretary.
Yes, exactly. Former Treasury Secretary of the US had been handed the editorship of the New York Post, you know, one of the leading metro papers in America, with no experience. And not only that, he'd gone on to say, well, I can do this and I can remain an active politician. And I'm going to work one day a week on Wall Street because George Osborne is working one day a week for BlackRock, the US investment firm, on a huge salary. And I'm going to work as an academic and I'm going to do after dinner speaking. I mean, I really do doubt whether that's actually humanly possible.
Yeah, so physically exhausting, and we haven't even mentioned the potential conflicts of interest. What do you think this all says about elite positions in Britain more generally? Is there really a shortage of talent that forces politicians to become editors at newspapers?
What galls me about this is that George Osborne, as a politician, will always talk about the need for social mobility, for everyone to have equality of opportunity and to get on, no matter where they came from. Actually, the way he's been handed this job by the son of a Russian billionaire, as you said, all of that runs completely contrary to the ideals of equality of opportunity, to the idea that anyone in Britain could get on wherever they come from. The lesson of disappointment is it doesn't matter what you know or how little you know, it matters who you know and how much power and how much credibility you can claim to hold. You've also got to ask yourself exactly what the son of a Russian billionaire might be hoping he might get in return from appointing a man who held one of the big jobs in Western politics for the past 6 years, who would have turned up at every single IMF and World Bank meeting, would have been in the G20 meetings, who would have set the course for the British government. I mean, imagine the access he now has indirectly to George Osborne's contacts.
Aditya Chakraborty, senior economics commentator for The Guardian. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
So what more can we say about Chuck Berry, who died over the weekend? His music clearly helped lay the foundation for rock and roll. No denying that. But here's something you probably did not know about Chuck Berry. He loved Indian food. Berry would sometimes even choose venues based on their proximity to the nearest Indian restaurant. That's why, it is rumored, he agreed to play at the Nottingham Royal Concert Hall in the 1990s. It's right across the street from an Indian restaurant called Mughal-e-Azam. That is some prime curry access. Sujat Sheikh is the founder of Mughal-e-Azam. So I know you've got dinner rush coming up, so I don't want to take too much of your time, Mr. Sheikh. What was it like, though, to have Chuck Berry show up at your restaurant all those years back?
Very nice. When he used to come here, the restaurant used to be packed solid. Whenever he played in concert hall, he used to make jokes about curry in the show, and he used to tell people to go across the road, is there good curry? And I cooked for him chicken tikka masala, and then I cooked jalfrezi, and he liked that.
Mm. Did you know who Chuck Berry was before he came in the restaurant?
We know, because every day, every week, we know when is the program. And I used to know through the concert hall people telling me he's coming.
So did he ever explain to you or anybody in the restaurant what it was about Indian food that he liked so much?
He loves the Indian food. He loves the Indian food so much.
But why? Yeah. Did he ever explain why?
No, I didn't ask him, though. I didn't ask him that. Yeah.
And would he eat before or after the show?
No, he used to come before. Actually, one of my friends went to see his show, and he came and tell me that when he's performing, he was telling, go across the road, it's a good Indian restaurant. And after the show, he was fully booked, whole restaurant is.
So do you have his picture on the wall?
Yes, we have. We have loads of pictures on the wall. There's so many people in his picture as well.
Do you listen to his music? Have you
Yes.
enjoyed it? You appreciate it?
I will always remember him.
What music do you like?
I like quite Indian music, Bollywood music.
So, Asha Bhosle, Lata Mangeshkar.
Lata Mangeshkar, Kishore Kumar, Mohammed Rafi.
It's all great stuff. So, I know you're obviously right across the street from the concert hall. You've had a few celebrities in there. Is there anybody that you haven't had in your restaurant that you hope one day will walk in and have your chicken tikka masala?
I was waiting for Michael Jackson.
Ah.
He's no longer with us. I was expecting Michael Jackson, but he didn't come.
So what do you recommend if I ever pay a visit to Mughal-e-Azam? What's the best thing to eat there?
First, if you're having a first curry, then you should have a chicken tikka masala or have a jalfrezi. Jalfrezi a bit tastier, more spicier.
I love jalfrezi with lamb.
With lamb jalfrezi. It's a very good dish.
That's what I'm going to order the next time I'm in Nottingham, whenever that may be. Well, Sujat Sheikh, thank you very much for being with us and for telling us about this little-known interest of Chuck Berry's. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Cajun, Geordie, Jamaican English. If you think our language has a lot of dialects, try Arabic. From Mosul to Marrakesh, you'll hear vastly different versions of Arabic, so different that you'd swear they're not even the same language. Well, here's one dialect of Arabic that may come as a total surprise, Judeo-Arabic. This is what Jews living in Arab countries spoke, and it was quite different from the Arabic spoken by Muslims and Christians in the region. Very few Jews still live in the Arab world, but in a few other places around the globe, you can still hear Judeo-Arabic spoken, like Montreal. That's where Alina Simone found Judeo-Arabic speakers for our podcast on language, the world in words.
Lizette Shashua, Gladys Catan, and Elsie Solomon are friends who grew up together in Baghdad, but left more than 40 years ago, part of a near-total exodus of Jews from the region. This is Judeo-Arabic. They speak the Iraqi variant of it. Even though it's their mother tongue, it was only after they left Iraq that they began to understand where the words they spoke really came from.
There were a lot of Turkish and Persian words and Indian words.
And Hebrew words.
We didn't realize that these were not Arabic words. It's only later that we realized some of the words were Hebrew. When we were in Israel and we said, oh, it's the same word you're using. No, it's a Hebrew word.
I'm a social linguist, so I'm interested in language variation.
This is Benjamin Hari, professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU. He describes Judeo-Arabic not as a dialect, but as a religiolect, a language variety spoken by a religious community.
A good example is Jewish English. The dialect or the language variety that Jews have been speaking and developing in the United States, for example, but also in the UK and in Australia, in South Africa and in other places, where they have elements from mostly Yiddish, but also from Hebrew. They mix these elements within the English. So it could be in the lexicon, like shul, which is a synagogue, but it also could be in the grammar. So I was bar mitzvahed in Los Angeles.
Judeo-Arabic is a form of Arabic, with borrowings from Aramaic, as well as the languages of various countries Jews migrated through over the centuries. It's hard for me to imagine what life in Jewish Baghdad was even like, so I asked Lizette to see some photos.
Yeah, somebody took pictures. Oh, yeah, this is me at age 9, having a candy cigarette, pretending it's a cigarette.
It was as a child that Lizette first began to notice things were going wrong in Iraq.
In 1958, when the king was killed, then the guy who killed the king was killed 4 years later, and then the guy that killed him. Coup d'etats, one after the other. It got to a stage when you hear boom, boom, boom. You say, oh, we don't go to school today. There's a revolution. Like it became a way of life.
Things had been getting worse for Jews even before Lizette and her friends were born. In 1948, when Israel was established, Iraq made Zionism a capital crime and began forcing Jews who left the country to give up all their property. Anti-Jewish sentiment spiked throughout the Middle East. Here's archival audio of King Faisal of Saudi Arabia.
We believe that all disturbances in our area have originated after the unjustified creation of Israel.
For 4 years, we were kind of under house arrest.
Gladys Catan is talking about her last years in Baghdad. She left in 1971.
They cut our telephone service. We were not allowed to work. We were not allowed to go to university. We were not allowed to meet together as friends. So therefore, you can't go to a coffee shop and meet with your friends. So we're literally under house arrest.
Outside of their homes, speaking Judeo-Arabic became dangerous. The girls had to disguise themselves, linguistically. Here's Lizette again.
In the street, we started to speak Muslim to each other so that they don't know that we are Jewish.
Muslim, meaning the version of Arabic the Iraqi Muslims spoke.
You see, the Muslim dialect was, and the Christian and the Jewish, they were each different from each other, and you could tell when you hear somebody talk.
When Elsie Solomon fled Baghdad, her family took a perilous route through northern Iraq into Iran. They crossed the mountains on foot and by mule, led by Kurdish guides who made it clear there was no time for self-pity.
And we started talking, you know, how cold it is, how bad it is. And they said, look at the lights there. If they hear you, they're going to shoot you.
All three of the women I spoke to in Montreal, all of them, assumed that once they were out of Iraq, they could finally cast off their disguises and, you know, just be themselves. But they found themselves stigmatized from an unlikely source, other Jews. The Ashkenazi, whose ancestors came from Eastern Europe, held themselves apart, and wherever the three women landed, be it Jerusalem or Montreal, they felt tension.
That it's the Ashkenazi Jews that came first, and we were embarrassed. Like
second-class
citizens. We were embarrassed. Like, I would apologize for being, you know, from the Middle East.
Things are better now within the Jewish community, but the stigma of speaking Arabic still lingers.
Unfortunately, try it even in New York. If you speak loud in Arabic at a restaurant, people will look at you. People are scared. It's crazy, but this is the situation. So in Israel, you identify Arabic, unfortunately, as the language of the enemy. A lot of my work is to convince the Israeli public that it's Jewish language. It's not the language of the enemy. It's crazy. It may be the language of our neighbors, but it's not the language of the enemy. You can't treat the language that way.
Now, with much of the Jewish Arabic-speaking population dispersed, the fate of the language rests with the diaspora. But as is usually the case, the children of these immigrants just want to fit in. In Montreal,
they are speaking English or French in school, and they want to be understood by their friends. They didn't particularly want to learn Iraqi Jewish dialect.
It was embarrassing. It was even unthought of for us to teach the kids Arabic. It was like, those beautiful kids speaking this guttural-sounding language? I mean, you know, you kind of say, no, you want to teach them English. You want them to become modern, cosmopolitan. I mean, this was, for us, a dead language.
But there's a growing effort to preserve the language. Lizette tells me one of their old schoolmates, who now lives in Israel, recently started teaching a class. And a couple of years ago, an online archive called Sephardi Voices was launched, featuring interviews with Judeo-Arabic speakers, as well as rare recordings like this one, of the last prayer service held in Iraq sometime in the 1990s. And 6,000 miles from Baghdad, for members of a certain generation, Judeo-Arabic lives on, in the living rooms of Montreal.
She's asking me, what did you cook today? I said, no, I didn't cook. I don't cook on Saturday. I don't cook, barely anyway. But I am dying for a tea.
That report from Alina Simone for our podcast, The World in Words. We have more at pri.org/language. I'm Marco Werman. LGBT Cubans face a lot of discrimination, but some drag show performers in Havana have each other's backs.
It's really important that before we perform, we support each other by holding hands and make ourselves strong before we go out in front of everyone.
That story is still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Malaria kills 500,000 people annually worldwide. Many of them are in West Africa, where efforts like supplying bed nets and spraying insecticides can't seem to control the entire mosquito problem there. Our next guest has seen what the future might be like in eradicating the mosquitoes that carry malaria. Ike Swetlitz is a reporter with STAT. He went to a small village in West Africa where researchers are ramping up a genetic experiment that could wipe out malaria-carrying mosquitoes. They're using a new powerful technology that has never been tested before in the wild. I asked Swetlitz to start by describing Bana, the village in Burkina Faso, where scientists want to conduct the experiment.
Bana is a village of 100, maybe 150 mud brick homes. Most of the people who live there, you know, 500 to 1,000 people or so, most of them have had some sort of experience with malaria, whether it's a disease that they get every year, for some people, a disease that their children may have died from. It's very close to home, and they're very excited for any sort of intervention, any sort of technology that will be able to do something about it.
So this would seem to be the perfect place to run experiments whose goal it is to eliminate malaria. What exactly are scientists planning for Bana?
The scientists are trying to figure out how to make one genetic modification pass very quickly into the entire mosquito population, such that most of the offspring are male. Since only females transmit the disease, then you see a decrease in the disease transmission.
Then there's this other technology known as a gene drive. Explain that.
So the gene drive is sort of the mechanism that allows that modification to spread quickly. So normally, any sort of given gene or any given trait, you know, only spreads to maybe half of the offspring. But with this gene drive, you can make that trait spread to all of the offspring. So if you can make this gene that will cause all of the offspring to be male, you can ensure that every one of the offspring inherits that trait that then causes all of their offspring to be male too.
As you report in your story and stat, I mean, there is a high threshold to educate the population in Bana who, as you say, they don't even have a word for gene in their language. And some believe that malaria can be spread by eating too much fatty food or sweet food. So tell me about some of the skepticism among the public and how they're getting won over to like this kind of science fiction technology.
The scientists are both themselves reaching out to the community and then also recruiting local leaders who are taking on more of this outreach so that the people who don't know how genetic modification works or aren't familiar with mosquito research will learn from people who are familiar to them. These are all scientists who have been living and working in Burkina Faso for many, many years. So these are not people that the Gates Foundation has sort of helicoptered in, right? The Gates Foundation has been, and the Target Malaria Project internationally has been building partnerships with scientists who are already working on malaria research in the country.
I mean, I'm personally interested in this because I've had malaria and it's not pretty. It's a very debilitating disease. And the Burkina Bay, as you say, they've seen generations fight this disease. Tell me about one of the Burkina Bay researchers and what motivates them.
Like yourself, the researchers there have also suffered from malaria and have seen a number of technologies come up over the past few decades, right? There's been insecticide, bed nets, things like that. And the researchers there are noticing that while the use of those technologies has been effective in reducing the rate of malaria, they've seen the mosquitoes there develop a resistance to the insecticides. They're starting to get scared that some of the methods that had been working might not be able to finish it off. I think that right now there's a lot of excitement for a new technology that might be able to get rid of malaria.
Ike Sweatlitz is a reporter with STAT. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
We wanted to learn more about the possible risks associated with an experiment involving gene drives, so we turned to Professor Gregory Lanzaro. He's director of the Mosquito Research Program at the University of California, Davis.
The risks that have been articulated deal with issues that are probably very unlikely. For example, one of the concerns is that if we're using a system that eliminates the mosquito from the environment, then are there potential impacts to the larger environment? For example, are there organisms that are relying on these mosquitoes as a food source? And so there has been some work done on this. And the results are that there are no predator species that specialize only on the one particular species that we're targeting. And that's the mosquito Anopheles gambiae, which is the primary vector of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa.
Is it possible that this technology could get into another species and accidentally wipe it out?
Yeah, so that's another issue. In West Africa, there is a related species, also a malaria vector, and that one does in fact mate with our target species. So I think the way that most of us are looking at this is if the transgene synthetic gene that we're releasing moves from our target species into this closely related one, that's fine. In fact, from our perspective, that's a benefit.
Right, but what if it gets into a non-target species that's helpful?
Yeah, so now if the transgene moves into a non-target species, I think that sort of thing with naturally occurring genetic elements that are described as selfish genes, these are naturally occurring things, and there has been movement of these selfish genes between fairly distantly related species, but it's rare. And then the question is, if it does move, what will it do? And the answer is probably not much.
Why are gene drives so powerful, and why are so many people worried about them?
What gene drive does is it takes advantage of the chemistry in the cell so that all of the offspring from a parent that's carrying one copy will inherit that gene. So it allows us to introduce genetic material into a wild population and have the frequency of that genetic material approach 100%.
And can die as a result.
That's one strategy. So one strategy would be that the gene that's put in there is a lethal gene that's going to kill the mosquitoes. The alternative strategy is doesn't have killing mosquitoes as its goal. So basically, the second strategy is called population replacement. And in that case, we're putting a gene into the mosquito that makes the mosquito incapable of transmitting the malaria parasite. And if we can introduce that gene into a natural population, we can convert that natural population from one that's capable of spreading malaria to a population made up of nearly 100% individuals incapable of transmitting the disease, and we'll eliminate the disease that way.
We can never really say, though, that there's zero risk with this. I mean, it's just hard to say, right?
That's right. I would say that the risks are, in my opinion, minimal, but there are risks that have been articulated.
Gregory Lanzaro runs the Mosquito Research Program at UC Davis. Professor, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Being LGBT in Cuba has never been easy, but in the capital, Havana, at least, there's more acceptance and visibility these days. That includes the much-loved drag performances by artists known as transformistas. Tipa Fernandez has our story.
It's Friday evening at a well-known theater in Havana, the Cine Acapulco, and a quartet of dapper-looking men croon love songs to the small audience. They're a playful group of singers, poking fun at themselves and the audience. The MC for the show is Alberto, a tall, handsome singer with high cheekbones and a finely trimmed goatee. People walking by Cine Acapulco hear the music and pop their heads in. Soon, a crowd swells at the doors. People are enjoying the show, yet only those inside might know that this male quartet are actually four lesbians who transform themselves into men to perform.
Yo me llamo Argelia Feyo Hernández.
Offstage, Alberto is Argelia.
Soy artesana, soy,
and she describes herself as an artist, a sexual health educator, and a transformista, which literally translates to one who transforms. I'm meeting Argelia at her home in an outer Havana neighborhood called Mantilla.
The main premise of my work is to empower women. It's to give visibility to women, and not just lesbians and bisexual women. My way to do this is through art.
So her show is art, she says. It's also activism, with a pointed message for the audience.
They will know that behind this man they see acting for them is a woman, like so many women worldwide who are fighting against homophobia, biphobia, fighting so there is no violence against girls.
Her home is a tiny two-bedroom wooden construction. She lives with her partner, Anna, and Anna's elderly father, who's suffering from dementia. They don't have a fridge, so they have to cook and eat everything on a daily basis. Doing the drag show doesn't pay much, so sometimes, to earn extra money, Argelia and her partner accept gigs as male singers, with an important catch.
They never, never, never tell the audience that we are actually women. We change and leave after the show, and the audience doesn't know that we were the performers. It's not what we want, but it pays us. And while we don't agree with their ideology of not telling the audience, we get a lot of visibility when we perform. And hopefully one day we'll break through that.
Transformismo shows also happen in the middle of busy streets. It's where Miriam Reyes does her show a few times a week, on a street aptly named Queen, Calle Reina, in the middle of central Havana.
I'm a transformista who is known for stopping traffic on Reina. I know it's kind of dangerous, but because of it, I'm famous.
Her show literally involves strutting out into oncoming traffic, straddling the double yellow lines in the middle of the street and posing, dancing. The street is her stage.
My whole life, I've wanted to dress as a woman, and my family always accepted me. They weren't critical, but because of machismo, some men don't accept people like me. Yet the reality is that society and even the planet have come around to see that this isn't some kind of sickness. It's our destiny.
And people love her. Alice Darlington Dickinson heads up a government network that protects the rights of lesbians and bisexuals in Havana. She says whether in the middle of traffic or on a stage, transformistas use art and humor to good effect.
Broadly speaking, it's a show, a cultural offering. And so far, audiences have accepted it.
She hopes these performances grow into something larger.
A transformista movement can happen. Today, there are individuals doing it, but they are not yet a movement.
As she prepares for another show in a local cultural hall, Argelia opens a folded piece of paper with some snippings of her own hair. She uses cooking oil to stick the hair on her face to form a goatee, and then she carefully uses a razor to give it shape. She's also deeply quiet during the whole transformation process.
It's really important that before we perform, we free ourselves from conversation. We support each other by holding hands. We share energy and make ourselves strong before we go out in front of everyone.
The crowd loves Argelia's performance as Alberto. He's suave, a charmer. And Argelia hopes her art will challenge people's conceptions of gender in a society steeped in defined gender roles. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Havana.
Before the break, we've got time for a quick birthday shout-out. This one's to a British singer known during World War II as the Force's sweetheart.
And that's all my news and music. You'll hear from me again next week. Good night, boys.
Again, don't know where.
Vera Lynn, singing one of her wartime hits, We'll Meet Again. Lynn is 100 years old today. Our colleagues at the BBC recently interviewed her. They asked her if she ever took singing lessons.
I just went once. I thought I could extend my range. But when she heard me sing, she says, no, I can't train that voice. It's not a natural voice. So I said, well, thank you very much, madam, and left. I wonder if she ever heard me when I was on the radio after that.
So will you please say hello to the folks that I know?
And to celebrate Vera Lynn's 100th birthday, her record label even projected her image on the iconic White Cliffs of Dover. Fitting, given one of her most well-known songs.
There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow. Just you wait and see.
Coming up on the show, Boston Public Schools ditch the old Mercator projection map. Find out why in just a minute. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We like maps here on the show. There's nothing like a map to help explain the world, but some maps do a better job of that than others, which is why some social studies teachers right here with Boston's public schools just got new world maps for their classrooms. They're not the traditional Mercator projections of the world that have been around for centuries, you know, where Alaska is larger than most of Western Europe. It's not, by the way. So the classrooms are now getting maps drawn using the Gall-Peters projection. Hayden Frederick Clark is director for cultural proficiency for the Boston Public Schools. So in a nutshell, Hayden, why introduce these new world maps into the schools?
First off, we wanted to make sure that we were doing a good job of affirming our students. 86% of our students are students of color, and many of them have parents, grandparents that are from places on the map that are underscaled and distorted. We wanted to create the opportunity for the students to see themselves in an appropriate fashion and counter the narrative that many of these places are small, insignificant, and not necessarily important to the world and its history, its functions, and its glory, quite frankly.
Why is Gall-Peters more accurate than Mercator?
The why is something that a cartographer would probably be more skilled at explaining. The how, I can speak to. I think the most glaring distortion on the Mercator map is the size of Africa. It's entirely too small. In many iterations, it said that Greenland looks about the same size as Africa. The United States looks like it's comparable in size. And we know that that's absolutely not true. Africa is, I believe, is 14 times larger than Greenland. In addition to that, Mexico is smaller than Alaska on a Mercator map. That's also quite backwards. Mexico is actually very much larger. There's problems with Brazil. Europe, and more specifically Germany, are near the center of the map. We know that not to be true. So a simple web search can give you iteration after iteration of distortions on the map. And again, in an effort to be accurate and give students precise information, we didn't want to leave them with that impression for the truth's sake. And we didn't want students who, again, many of them are from the Caribbean, many are descendants of Africa. We didn't want to tell them where you are from is small and insignificant. The marginalization of some of those places in the history books is already a glaring problem. We didn't need another add-on. Then arguably shifting the maps first is a bit easier lift because it doesn't require as much work, and it can something that can resonate with small children as well as older children who have the capacity to grapple with some more difficult issues and more complexities.
You've taught before, right, Hayden?
Yes. Let me,
yeah. Has the switch from Mercator to Gall Peters created a conversation that you hadn't anticipated, and what kind of questions are you getting?
What I can say from my own experience as an instructor, people enjoy the truth, and people, especially classroom teachers, generally want to give their students the best and most authentic product that they can. So I do not anticipate we'll get anything other than surprise and awe and arguably a push to do more of these right. things. To uncover some of the things that we accept as true. But when we dig a little bit deeper, there's a more complicated story.
Hayden Frederick Clark is the Director of Cultural Proficiency for Boston Public Schools. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
So I was down in Austin, Texas this past weekend. The World was one of the sponsors of a music showcase that we told you about last week called Contraband. It featured music from countries listed on Trump's travel ban. I got to say, we had a fantastic turnout, and the artists on the bill were super excited to perform. There was a lot of great music, obviously. And before we leave you today, I'd like you to hear the thoughts of a few of the musicians who joined us about the travel ban and what's at stake for arts and culture.
My name is Dina Al-Safar, and my family is Iraqi. I always identify as Iraqi American. And part of a big reason why I identify as Iraqi is because people see me that way. People always say, "Where are you from?" The travel ban is just the next chapter in what's been going on for decades, starting, I'd say, with the Gulf War and the sanctions and the second Gulf War and September 11th and you name it. There has been one thing after the other, and I've been playing music the whole time. Music helps to connect people in a way that words or politicians or news reports can't. I love it when artists come from other parts of the world to the United States because I think it opens people's minds. They kind of get this connection through their heart, through their musical appreciation, and it kind of transcends political rhetoric.
My name is Emmanuel Jal, and originally I'm from Sudan, which is split now, so I'm part of South Sudan.
Emmanuel Jal is a former child soldier from Sudan, emigrated to Canada, and became a rap superstar.
All human beings suffer from fear, and fear does not allow us to think creatively. So when we take courage, we can be able to diffuse the worries. We can be able to look beyond what we think about the other person. We live in different times now. There's insecurity in the United States. So Americans have a responsibility to protect their country so people don't enter in. But the way I look at it is there not another better option that we can look and explore than just put in a situation like this, dividing families. This could make other people more angry. When a human being wants to do something evil, the borders don't stop them. They'll get there. So I'm saying it's a room to debate and challenge the situation. And I'm really, America has demonstrated hope to be able to challenge their president, the court standing by the law.
My name is Mohsen Namjoo. I'm originally from Iran and right now living in New York.
Mohsen Namjoo can't actually travel to Iran because his music has been deemed controversial. But for people from the six countries on the travel ban list coming here,
culturally, it's going to be has some effects because, you know, the concept of the United States or Canada is based on having this multiculturalism. That was my first time in Austin. I was walking on the street. I was amazed by seeing this diversity of people, of races, of music, of, you know, it's like that all of them are get together just because of one thing, one word, music.
By the way, this music comes courtesy of Iranian electronica musician Ash Kusha. He lives in London, had his visa approved to come to Texas, but didn't get it in time to make our contraband concert. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Marco Werman with you, and we'll be back again tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.